This is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places.
Hello and welcome to Better Places, the podcast from Consilio where we talk about all things planning, politics and property. I'm Nathan Parsad-Wyatt.
And I'm Luke Francis.
And we're back after actually quite a while.
Ages.
We haven't recorded one in some time for various...
We got usurped, didn't we, by colleagues?
Yeah,
Katie
we have.
Did one.
Yeah, Katie did one. I think Nick did one. And yeah, it's just been quite busy, hasn't it, over the last couple of months.
So but we're back.
But we are back. And it's been an eventful couple of months. And we've got a great guest on the show later on.
We do indeed.
Who is it, Luke?
It's Councillor Anthony Okereke from the London Borough of Greenwich.
Very good. Yeah, no, it should be a good chat with him. But as you know, we like to start these with a bit of a discussion roundup as to what's been going on. And, well, politically, it's not been dull for local government at all. We had elections everywhere, well, quite a few places, not in London, but across the whole of England, really.
Yeah, 8,000 seats.
8,000 seats. And I think, you know, now the dust has settled on those, I think we can say it was pretty bad for the Conservatives.
Yeah, yeah, it wasn't great, was it?
I mean, there was a lot of expectation management, you know, could lose up to 1,000 seats. And, you know, I think privately, Conservative HQ was hoping for far fewer losses than that. But I think the perfect storm... came about, really, and I think it was 1,063 seats or councillors that they lost, which is...
It's bad, isn't it?
It's quite bad, and I think that what's interesting is to see who gained from that loss. There was no doubt, you know, those of us who were out campaigning and stuff, there was a pretty anti-conservative sentiment, which is not massively surprising.
At a national level.
At a national level, and then that, I think, has been compounded by various local issues... in some cases, but what was interesting to see was, you know, it didn't automatically all go to Labour as the net beneficiaries.
No.
And in fact, what I kept finding was, you know, the Lib Dems are back for sure in local government, if nothing else, and they managed to increase their number of seats by 407. But also interestingly, the Green wave, and you know, the Greens gaining 241 councillors and actually taking control in some places.
Yeah,
which is pretty amazing, really. I mean, you know, the Greens have had an increasingly strong presence in local government, but it kind of came out of nowhere in some cases. I mean, in some councils, you've got, you know, people who thought they were paper candidates who are now suddenly running the show.
Yeah, and some interesting shift from Conservative to Green, which feels like a really big jump.
It does, except for I think there are a lot of Conservative voters who are environmentalists at their heart. They, you know, I kind of call the King Charles environmentalists, if you like.
Zach Goldsmith.
Yeah, exactly. You know, go back to Cameron's Vote Blue, Go Green days. And I think there is an element of that. And
that's a good slogan.
And, you know, yeah, it worked for Cameron, didn't it?
Yeah. Fair play.
Other slogans were then better that finished him off. Other three-word slogans. but I think, you know, whether that could be replicated at a general election or not, I don't know. But Labour did very well as well. It's important to say, you know, 537 increase in councillors and taking control, I think, of pretty much all their targets that they wanted to. So, you know, it was a pretty bad night for the Conservatives, Lib Dems, Labour, Greens, and a sort of selection of independents really being the net beneficiaries of that. But what was interesting, it was just, you know, I mentioned before that it's kind of the perfect storm, and I think that's true in that, you know, you've got the national picture, you've got... you know, all of the national issues that are going on, that people don't feel like things are working, and kind of a message of change is quite a strong one. But alongside that, you had a lot of local issues, and certainly the Greens really championed things like, you know, not building on Greenbelt and the, you know, sewage in our streams message, and lots of other kind of protecting the natural environment type messaging, for fear of overdevelopment and all sorts of other things,
which does lend itself to conservatism with a small c.
Well, it does. I mean, you know, there's no doubt in some of the towns and villages across the country, that is a very, very powerful message.
And to be fair, you'd assume that not pumping raw sewage into waterways is fairly universal. I can't think of a political party that is...
No, it's probably that. Yeah. I think, unfortunately, it's not going to be within the gift of the 481 Green councillors to...
stop it.
Yeah. But without going on a massive tangent about how complex and difficult it is to actually resolve that problem.
That's on our other podcast, isn't it?
I was going to say, you can listen to that. It's far, you know, far less fun. Yeah. It depends what you're into, I suppose. A bit far less fun.
Of course.
But so there was this huge, you know, anti-conservative sentiment that all came together. And I think, you know, we saw the similar thing happen in London actually last year, where, you know, Westminster went to Labour for the first time, Barnet, Wandsworth, all these, you know, former boroughs that have been trending in a certain direction, finally getting over the line for Labour. I think that was kind of replicated across the country.
I'll throw this out there. I'm not even sure I entirely agree with it myself, but... We love a proposition. I feel like this most recent round of local elections earlier this month and 2022's felt like a vote against something, not a vote for something. What about that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, but I think that is what you constantly see reflected in the polls as well, is that, you know, there is an anti-conservative sentiment because people aren't happy at the moment, mainly because of the economy, but also a whole range of other reasons. And so they're open to listening to an alternative. I don't yet think that they have been convinced of one particular alternative. And, you know, some Conservative voters definitely just stayed at home. I saw some analysis this morning that some Green voters that came out are actually non-voters normally, but they were convinced by the message and so came out to vote for something that was different. The Lib Dems doing their classic master trick, really, of facing one way nationally and another way locally. Yeah. And opposing everything development-wise at a local level. And, you know, frankly, let's not sugarcoat it, they are the NIMBY party.
They are.
And
Who was it? John Redwood? One of the senior Tory MPs said we can't out NIMBY.
Senior Tory MP? I wouldn't describe John Redwood as that, but maybe we should.
I mean senior by age.
By age, yeah, exactly. Authority. Yeah. No, if you're listening, John.
All the best.
All the best. I think... I mean, the Lib Dems doing that, yeah, classic thing. And also Labour doing it in some places.
Well, except that door's been firmly closed,
well,
hasn't it?
Well, which brings us to what's been happening since the local elections, which is very, very interesting because avid listeners will remember when we first started doing this podcast that we were talking about how I think we felt housing was going to become more and more part of a national conversation because it is the ultimate generational inequality, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. And that has only been trending one way for the last decade and longer, but particularly in the last decade. And I think it's definitely following the local elections, and I think there's probably an element of, you know, local councillors are not going to have to face the electorate again across the country before the next general election. So it opens the door for the national conversation about housing.
Yeah.
And Keir Starmer has seized on this in quite a clever way, I think, which has, you know, basically been to say that he wants to be on the side of the builders, not the blockers. Mm-hmm. He's opened the door for, I think, what many of us would describe as a sensible conversation about Greenbelt.
Yeah.
And at a time where the historic party of home ownership, the Conservative Party, has, you know, largely bowed to pressure from some backbench MPs who are concerned about this, but also lots of local councillors, and decided, in effect, that they will remove mandatory housing targets and therefore get rid of what many of us would say is the biggest stick for local authorities.
And also the shield as well, right? You can blame Westminster for building homes.
Yeah, exactly.
If we don't do it, someone else is going to come in and do it for us.
Yeah, so doing that, well, I just do not see a way how that doesn't lead to fewer homes being built, at least in the short term. And Keir Starmer said he'll bring those back. So, you know, for the first time, it goes back to that, you know, are you convinced by the alternative? For the first time, there is an aspirational message from the Labour Party, which is we will build more homes for the next generation. I think there is then a debate going on. Well, so that's a clever move from Keir Starmer anyway. Whether or not that's, you know, an MP pointed out to me the other day that it's all well and good Keir Starmer saying that, but, you know, there's several MPs that we know that are opposing, you know, two-storey developments in their own constituencies and everything else, but yeah. You know, it's worked for the Lib Dems, so...
But this is always the challenge, right, which is as soon as that came out, you know, as soon as Keir stood up and said, you know, we're going to be essentially the party of pro-development, the stories start rolling in of... you know, shadow cabinet members or senior Labour MPs who have blocked local development. And I think this sums up the challenge, right, which is everyone agrees we need to build more homes, you know, everyone understands the importance and the scale of the crisis. But locally, these things are contentious, they're unpopular, they lose you votes. And so you can have everyone agreed about the nature of the problem and to be honest, large parts of what the solution is, but just not where it loses them votes. So I think we're starting to see Labour put a lot more meat on the bones in terms of what their reforms would look like and why housing is going to be their priority. It's been met, you know, largely positively by the industry, I think.
I think so. Look, I think meat on the bones is maybe a stretch too far. We've seen an aspiration which is probably more in line with the industry's thinking than the current government's aspirations. But I think the fact is it shows an understanding of the problem and that planning is part of the problem.
Well, let me give you a taste of some of that meat.
Okay, go on.
Shame. 70% home ownership as a target.
Yeah.
I think we're probably going to see numbers put on in terms
70%
of
70% of who? Because is that not just like we'll build 300,000 homes a year? I mean,
well, know. So they push back a little bit on the 300,000 a year target because they take into account the shortfall. So
it's 1.2 million a year now.
Yeah, everywhere.
Everywhere.
I reckon we're going to see something around a million new social homes over the next 10 years. I think they'll talk about two terms of parliament rather than one, because that's always a smarter thing to do. Starting to talk up development corporations, you know, local government delivery. So we are starting to see, you know, some of those slightly more specific policy ideas that have obviously been sounded out in industry are fairly well received. Planning reform is obviously going to be one of the big ones, and we know how difficult that is. You know, a lot of people have tried and failed.
Well, I think ultimately when planning reform was proposed, without going on a massive tangent here, but when planning reform was proposed by Rob Jenrick to move to a more zonal system where people would allocate sites for development at local plan stage, Keir Starmer described it as the developer's charter. Well, so, you know, the idea that it just shows you that it's harder to do this in practice.
Well, I think, you know, the fact we've had 17 housing ministers in the last 13 years shows that, you know, just how politically poisonous this is.
It's just a very difficult, it's a very difficult thing to solve. But I think what's interesting is the debate that's also occurring in the Conservative Party over this. And it is essentially two wings of the party between the perhaps younger, more ambitious, let's have an offer for the next generation side, who really think it's a mistake to not build homes, and those sort of very pro-development side of the party, because, you know, they want to buy their own homes, understandably. And those who are perhaps saying, you know, there's been too much here and, you know, we're not opposed to development, but we don't want it here.
Yeah.
And I think at the moment the Prime Minister is trying to satisfy both and therefore and actually doing neither. Because... you know, I'm just very interested to see what the actual offer is going into the next general election. And whilst it's, you know, it's not one of the Prime Minister's five priorities, and it may not necessarily be the thing that decides the next election, I do think that the Conservative Party needs to be very careful about being seen to be not on the side of those who aspire to do better. I mean, that has literally been a core principle of...
It's got to feel like a majority of people, hasn't it? There are very few people aspiring to do worse.
No, but I think that one of the reasons why people have historically moved, you know, not voted Labour, if you're an electrician in the home counties who wants to go on a holiday a couple of times a year or once a year and have a nice car and have a nice house, is because I think the view is Labour are going to tax you to oblivion. Mm-hmm. Whereas... actually, at the moment, and historically, it's like the Conservatives want me to own my own home and are offering products to do that and are building the homes to build a better future for me and my family. I think if we lose that, and if the party loses that, then and you end up being effectively for a generation of people who are already homeowners, I don't think that's a good position long term for the party to be in. Whether or not it's a good position in the short term remains to be seen, but I just feel like, you know, you're losing an entire generation of people. To basically be on the side of NIMBYs.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, anyway, I'm not writing the manifesto, but perhaps I ought to be.
If you were, John, if you're listening, get in touch.
That's it. But enough from us.
Lovely. Let's Let's get Anthony on. Talk about Greenwich, shall we?
And I am delighted to say that we're now joined by the leader of Greenwich Council, Anthony Okereke. Anthony, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's really good to be here today. I've actually been really excited about coming on this and gearing myself up.
You just before we started recording, you were humming the theme tune to our podcast to me as an audition to for the next series to be the voice of the podcast. That we've got to start with what you were doing yesterday. Do you just want to explain what you were up to yesterday and why you were doing it?
Yes, 100%. So I was raising money for our mayor's charity. So at the moment, our mayor, who's just coming to an end of his term, is raising money for two wonderful charities, Greenwich and Bexley Community Hospice and Lymphoma Action. And so I was abseiling off a 17-storey tower building yesterday, trying to raise money for these two wonderful charities. I've completed it. I'm back on the ground leading Greenwich.
Still with us.
Yeah, still with us. And just, really delighted and over the moon. So if you're out there and you're listening to this podcast, please, please, please donate, because we want to support these fantastic charities and the wonderful things that they do for families who are going through trauma or cancer treatment or end-of-life care. So please get involved and donate to them.
Absolutely. We will be putting a link in the podcast as well. So anyone who'd like to donate to those two very worthwhile charities, please make sure you do. But we are delighted that you made it safely to the ground and that you're able to join us today. I mean, let's kick off with, I guess, a bit about you, really. So you've been the leader of Greenwich Council for coming up to a year, May last year. Tell us a bit about your political journey and how you got here.
So I guess, I got elected in 2018. But before that, politically, I obviously joined the Lib Party when I was in university, in the wake of the Tories coming in and taking government. But really inspired by everything that Labour did historically, especially to tackle poverty. So I then, when we lost power, I wasn't a member, but it was a loss that prompted me to join. Then obviously went into Parliament, worked a few years for different MPs, came back out and straight into local government in 2018, with the aim of just really trying to help out locally. You know, it was never my intention, shall I say, to be in my current position, but I've just, continued and just driven forward about thinking about my area, my place, tackling poverty through local government, how we improve people's healthcare, and changing places and creating places. And it's almost where it's led me to where I am now, leading Greenwich through a vision, a strategic vision that sees us want to be better and greater, because it's a wonderful place.
Tell us a bit about those priorities, the ambition to make the borough a better place for the people who live there. When you came in this time last year, or almost this time last year, what were your key priorities when you looked around?
So I think for me, one thing was one core vision that really focused everything and drove into that vision. That vision for me, when I think about local government and our role, what we're here to do, I think about how everything comes together to improve the quality of life and health of our residents. So for us, coming in with all councillors, we sat down and developed a vision. And that vision is about improving the quality of life and health of our residents. Now, the core building blocks for all of that is about housing, it's about accessibility to health services, it's about good education and growing up in a place where you can grow old. It's about being able to get the right support if you're ever in need of support. So one of the things we did is establish a vision that focuses on people, places, economies, but also communities, and also the organisation itself, the council, ensuring that it's a resilient and tactful organisation that can respond to the different challenges within our communities.
It's a big piece of work, right? It's when you sit down at that desk for the first day and you've got a couple of hundred thousand residents. You're like, right, where do I start?
Exactly, it is absolutely massive. And I think if you look within our corporate plan, which is called Our Greenwich, what you'll see is 20, and I'm not joking, 20 missions that outline what we're trying to achieve for Greenwich. It's a plan that takes us to 2030. It focuses on how we develop our economy to make sure we have an inclusive economy. How can our communities be resilient? How can we create place? What do our neighborhoods look like? you know, how do we ensure that children and young people can reach their full potential? It's bold, it's ambitious, but more importantly, it's a 10-year, in my mind, 4-year plan, but it seeks to start to build or put the spades in the ground to take us to 2030.
And how important is that political vision, do you think, when you're sort of setting these things out? Because, you know, the council is a huge organisation responsible for such a range of things, right? From your, you know, you've got Greenwich Builds, a housing delivery arm, but you've got, you know, so many frontline services, so many things that the council has to deliver.
Yes.
How important for you is that political vision and you setting that from the top?
I think it's vitally important for me because me and you both know resources in local government are not a lot. And therefore, if I'm going to invest in Greenwich, I have to make sure I'm doing parallel to the vision, doing it that makes in a way that aligns to what I'm trying to achieve. And obviously, when you don't have that vision, you may not be able to understand where your investments are going. I would argue and say that we have firm commitments to what we're trying to achieve for Greenwich. And if you look at our budget, you'll see the firm commitments coming through there. And the reason why I did that is because we want our vision to drive forward our budget process. Our vision aligns to our budget process, and we can draw a line directly from the commitment to the budget. And that is basically showing I'm going to put my money, the council's money, our residents' council, the taxpayers' money, where our mouths with in how we're trying to transform and change lives locally.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you touched on it there. I think it was the first thing you mentioned when you talked about those key priorities was housing. Mm. What is it that Greenwich needs when it comes to housing? We were chatting just before we started recording, yeah, about housing waiting lists. And I asked you if I think I'd read that it was about 20,000, and you corrected me and said it's much higher than that in Greenwich, but that it's like the requirements are slightly different. But tell us a bit about what the housing requirements are, what the challenges in Greenwich.
Well. Sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so just on houses, obviously, current housing waiting list is 28,000. With different priorities, we have a priority bandings of A, B, and C. And obviously, prior to me becoming leader, I was obviously cabinet member for housing. Our council housing waiting list is growing, that's number one. Our population is growing, we're inheriting other populations from inner London, not only are we doing that, our temporary accommodation numbers are growing. We know that there's a housing crisis in London, and all of us are going through the same housing crisis. So housing is a big, massive issue. Now, with a housing waiting list of 28,000, there's no way in this current, in the next 4 years of my term, that I'm going to be able to house everyone on the housing waiting list. You know, we're currently through our Greenwich Builds program building 1,750 new council homes. And in parallel to that, the big ambition for us is how can we enable more housing and development to come forward? So making sure that we're having open and transparent conversations with partners who want to invest in our borough, and also speaking about how development coming forward and affordable housing coming forward. As well as that, you know, finding about how we can start to think about regeneration. You know, Greenwich is a wonderful place, a growing area. We've started to go down the journey of regeneration long before I became a councillor. Now it's time to rethink about what more can we regenerate and how can we develop more places to grow our communities, to make sure we have enough affordable housing in the borough so that we can have key workers and people that are invested here can live here. You know, right now we don't want to see, we have that huge shift, or should I say migration from London, where people are moving outwards just to be able to afford to stay around the almost the Kent Belt areas, just to be able to travel in and work on our local hospital. All local authorities should be thinking about what is their housing strategy, how are they planning for their population in a few years to come, and how are they making sure that there's a diversity of affordability in the market when it comes to a home, because that's how people progress. It's through housing that people progress to the next stages of their life. If you don't have that, as they say with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if you don't have that, you can't think about that next step.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, without that foundation and that stability as a very basic sort of like a human right, right?
Exactly.
To have somewhere that's safe, secure, and affordable. Mm. I mean, it's an incredibly ambitious house building programme that the council are undertaking there. How does that work in practice? Is it council owned land that you're looking at? Do you have sort of brownfield sites that you're looking at? Because, you know, in some, you know, we were chatting with Danny Beals a couple of weeks ago, and one of their big challenges as an inner London borough of Camden is that the limited number of brownfield sites. Is it the same in Greenwich, or are you looking at bringing forward your own land, council owned land for development as well?
Yeah, so interestingly, I'm really glad you asked that question, because I think there needs to be a recognition that there isn't enough land for councils to build on, right? Mm-hmm. And not only is there not enough land, it's really difficult and expensive for councils to buy land at market level. Every time I see a patch of land that I get the council to bid on, we're priced out. So yep. A mix of our 1,750 programme is a mix of things. One, on brownfield land, which we're building on. What that limits us, because obviously it's small sites. So small sites, you know, 3, 4, 7, 10 here and there. There's two large sites, which are Kidwick Proc Road Scheme, where we're building about 113 homes, our Brooks Scheme, which we're building about 80, and then a mix of smaller sites. But as well as doing that, and I think it's key to recognise that we have to think intelligently about how we deliver council homes. It's buying off the market, so we're buying about circa 200 homes from a developer. We have a housing delivery program that is mixed. One is building ourselves, self-delivery, but also buying properties off the open market from things that are coming forward.
So you're looking at those sort of innovative, different approaches, right? Because
exactly,
you know, there are so many challenges. You know, we sort of day in, day out, we work with local authorities, with developers, with investors, and I think everyone is feeling these pressures from different angles, and, you know, costs, inflations, land values, labour shortages, and in many ways the Greenwich Builds challenges are the same as those of a private developer as well, I guess, right? Which is how do you make this stack up financially so you can deliver what you need?
100%. I mean, we're having those exactly the same challenges you've just alluded to. Is what we're having, where we're seeing you know, construction costs going up. We're having to relook at schemes and reappraise them, and also borrow more money. We're very quite firm in that we're not going to stop. We know as a council we cannot afford to stop, and therefore we need to keep going. So where financial viability is quite difficult, we're going back and looking at schemes and you know, getting more money into them to make sure that they can deliver that. Our Kibble Park Road site was exactly that. But also doing value engineering around our schemes to make sure that actually, can we change it or put some additional cheaper steel here or something like that, just to make sure that the scheme is viable. But one thing we're not going to do is stop. One thing that I didn't add just to my last comment is about the next step is thinking about regeneration, because ultimately we're doing direct delivery ourselves of our own housing. But the next phase is actually we need to think about how we regenerate areas. And obviously we have to do that through partnership work. It's very costly to do regeneration ourselves. So that's another thing that we need to be thinking about. And, you know, taking a view of what a regeneration strategy looks like for Greenwich is going to be very, very important for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it feels like the big challenge, right? And actually it's interesting because housing is a, you know, it feels perennial, right, that we talk about the housing crisis, and certainly for as long as I can remember, it always feels like there has been a shortage, and that, you know, housing has been one of the key political challenges. And yet no political party, I don't think, and I say this as, you know, someone who's been a member of the Labour Party since his teenage years and has worked for the Labour Party, I don't think any political party has quite got to grips with the scale of the challenge yet. I think, you know, there have been periods where we have done more than others, but that it has been an ongoing challenge, and one that is only getting more acute, and particularly with the cost of living crisis now, I think more people than ever are in unaffordable housing, and it's becoming this focus for so many local authorities, is how you tackle that and how you make the finances stack up, because presumably with housing waiting lists that long, and, you know, I think it was 1,600 homeless households in temporary accommodation, there's a huge financial cost to the local authority on that side as well, right? So there's a financial incentive to resolve this.
Yeah, 100%. I think you're right. That the burden that temporary accommodation places on our residents is huge, but also the burden it places on our council resources is absolutely huge. So the more we can get people into settled accommodation, long-term accommodation, get them into our home, the better it is for us, because it frees up resources, you know. You know, but more importantly, it's not just about resources, it's about a decent life, you know. I cannot tell you what it would feel like to be stuck in a hotel room, not knowing that the resources I have is probably just a microwave, and if that, to warm food up. That's not a decent lifestyle. And at the moment, we're in a situation where so many people in their lives are, that is their lifestyle, you know, they're in houses that are not suitable for their needs. And therefore, it's a whole country issue at the moment. And there needs to be some real thinking about how we change that. Now, I think local councils are doing a huge amount to think about how they move that forward. But more importantly, we need that incentive for government to step up and help deliver that. And I think they can do more to help councils regenerate and also make sure that we can get land in, within our own areas to start thinking about how we regenerate spaces and create new places.
Well, we're gonna come on to national in a second, because it'll be useful to pick your brains about what more Westminster can be doing to support your aspirations in Greenwich. But one thing that I'm always interested in whenever we talk to local government leaders is, if you look at last May's elections, and Labour did really well in Greenwich, and Labour did well actually across London in a lot of places, but there was almost a NIMBY undercurrent to a lot of those elections. And actually what you saw was a lot of political parties, often in opposition, attacking incumbent councils for a sense of overdevelopment or getting development wrong. Is that something that you've seen in Greenwich? Is it something you have to tackle? You know, the idea that communities maybe don't want the homes being built in the numbers that you need to build them?
Yeah, yes, I would say that is something that we have seen personally. I think I have to remind listeners of my almost month one of my leadership when I went to planning committee, and we had a huge amount of people come out and speak against one of our schemes, because we fund an organisation called Meridian Homestar, which is a company we started, but it's no longer part of the council, to develop private rented sector homes. And obviously we had a huge amount of people come and speak against that application, which was 100% affordable housing. But I think you're right. Housing, once you have the responsibility of delivering housing and understanding the challenges, you just get on with it. And when you don't have that responsibility, it's very hard to understand why it's such a big issue, number one. But number two, I think we need to do better in communicating what we're trying to achieve, but also how we tap into the voices of those who are directly going through not having housing security. And I think the planning system sometimes doesn't enable that. I think it needs changes, but I think there is this anti-development kind of narrative sometimes, because I think it's hard to get it, to get housing sometimes, but also how people benefit from housing. You know, some of the arguments you hear is, oh, it's going to impact my house values, you know. And you know, I think that those narratives and the fear, you know, we sometimes I've heard comments of, you know, who are these people that are going to be coming in? There is an assumption of the types of individuals that live in council housing. But one thing I would say, from my experiences, those assumptions are always wrong. Actually, we have a lot of fantastic, wonderful people doing great things and living their lives, growing and living out their aspirations in council homes. And that's just the way the community, it's the community that are coming to these spaces. So those concerns, I think we can robustly speak to them and speak against them that people have, but also demonstrate what wider investment comes from making sure that you have a diverse population and what good housing investment looks like and what it does for the community.
So that's interesting, because I guess it ties back to this idea of having a clear political vision, which makes it much easier to counteract some of that narrative by explaining what the alternative is and what the implications are of not delivering these homes. Is there a particular demand in Greenwich? Is there a certain type of housing or development that you need, or is it fairly universal?
So it is. I would say family housing is a really important thing that we do need coming forward. I think that's always an area that gets kind of squeezed out. But all types of housing are important. Also purpose-built student accommodation, because we're losing family homes to student accommodation, and sometimes accommodation that is, it's easier, it's cheaper to live in a house of multiple occupation. So I would say mix of affordable housing across all different family demographics is really important. So singles, couples, starter, people starting a family for the first time, established families, and people downsizing. We need a mix of affordable housing, because actually that's where the squeeze is. There's not enough affordable family housing out there at the moment. And if you look at the company I refer to, Meridian Home Start, where we fund to build affordable PRS, actually we're seeing some good family housing come through there, as well as our Greenwich Council house building scheme.
Well, look, housing is definitely one part of it, but one thing you've talked about an awful lot in the last year has been transport and the importance of good transport links into and out of Greenwich. Why is transport so important for a borough like Greenwich?
So, I mean, if you look at Greenwich at the moment, transport-wise, so if you go to somewhere like North Greenwich, we have our North Greenwich Tube Station, which is at Greenwich Peninsula. If you come to Woolwich, prior to Crossrail opening, we had the Woolwich South Eastern Railway Station, National Railway Station, and then we also had the DLR at Woolwich. And now, then you have other stations in Eltham and other stations around. But if you look at infrastructure-wise, when it comes to transport, especially sustainable transport like trains and train vehicles to move us around. In comparison to other authorities, we're quite cut off. We don't have a lot of transport. So if you go to Eltham, you know, how we're connected in Eltham is not that great. Also, connections across the borough aren't that great. Whereas if you go to some other local authorities in London, they have multiple tube stations in an area. So we haven't had much of that investment in transport infrastructure, and we need more sustainable transport, especially as a council who has a zero carbon 2030 agenda. We need to make sure that we can provide good sustainable transport options for our local residents. Our residents care about going from A to B, and they do that. They want to do that in the most quicker way possible and in the most sustainable way possible, because they care about air pollution. They know that it's affecting us, and we all know it evidentially from our data. But that's why it's important. That's why we're campaigning. So actually, just this week at Cabinet, we set out our proposals for the DLR extension from Beckton to Thamesmead to invest in that area to make sure that we can get a good sustainable transport in place, so that we can unlock the amount of the opportunity area that's down there to unlock housing, to house people. And that's what transport can do for us. But more importantly, as well as that, we know that cycling, walking, and all of those kind of things, those active travel transport meeting modes, are what's going to help improve people's lives. And that taps into our overarching vision as a council, is encouraging more people to use more sustainable means like walking and cycling to get around. And therefore, we also have to reflect that investment in our roads as well.
And would that be your big ask of, you know, looking sort of, if you're knocking on Sadiq's door or you're knocking on down at Whitehall, would that be the big ask? DLR, would that extension be the key transport ask?
So I wouldn't say it would be the key transport ask. I would say it is Sadiq's biggest ask. It's his number one strategic project in his plan for London, is the DLR extension from Beckton to Thamesmead. So we are totally aligned. My ambition is his ambition, which is absolutely great. I'm happy in the context of Silvertown, we're really aligned on that one. Yes, so it is a key assessment, as well as that we do need bus reviews in Greenwich, and we need to start thinking about how we get better connections towards the Eltham area, because actually it takes, if you're coming from Eltham across Greenwich, it takes a few two buses at least to get here, and that makes it hard. But we are investing on ourselves, like I talked about the budget process. We're investing 3.1 million to improve our transport network to make sure we can make Greenwich just a cleaner, safer and healthier place to live. 1 million of our own budget is coming in. Some additional funding from the Mayor of London also coming into that as well.
That's brilliant. Well, look, I've taken up a lot of your time, but I just want to touch on the national picture as well. You know, we are, well, let's say a year or so out from a general election, let's say September next year, but we've also got the mayoralty coming up in May next year as well. But thinking about Westminster, thinking about central government, what more could the government be doing to support your aspirations in Greenwich? What would be your big asks?
Well, in terms of big asks, I do think about, like, you know, we have talked about transport a lot, and I think, you know, we do need to think about transport more broadly across the UK, just leaving transport side to the side. I think when it comes to central government as a local authority, there are key things that we need to do. You know, we're talking about how we regenerate our high streets, how we grow our economies. Our high streets are key to that. So obviously you've got the Levelling Up Bill that's coming through Parliament at the moment. It's at law stage, I can't really remember. But there's key powers in that are going to be enable us to take more action. You know, CPO powers are incredibly long and really difficult. And if we want to, like, councils are so fundamentally well placed to change their areas. We are the conveners of our area. And essentially, if you want to be able to change our economies, we have to be able to use CPO powers quite quickly and get in and be able to change our places. So you'll see the work that Greenwich has done historically with CPO. But actually, we have areas like our Spray Street scheme, and we've just completed the CPO process there. But it takes an entirely long time to be able to do that. So CPO powers is key for a council. When it comes to housing, obviously, grant funding from central government. You know, we haven't had huge amounts of grant funding into local government for years. The only investment, the only grant funding that comes through is obviously through the GLA when it comes to delivery for housing. It's not huge. It's really not huge. So if you look historically from is it Addison Act all the way to like 2018. It's from 2018 you start to see investment come through. If we're trying to change the housing crisis, if we're trying to get more affordable homes on the market, there needs to be a public funded housing delivery plan for local councils, which local councils deliver that through direct self-delivery, because we understand our own places, and a bigger investment in planning, because we need to be forward thinking about, if we want to change people's health for the better, councils need to help lead planning, envision planning. Right now, what's happening is, you know, I love master planning. What's happening is master planning kind of happens when we all start looking at the site. We need to start thinking about places in the next 10 to 20 years and start planning forward. And there needs to be an investment in planning to do that. As well as that, I would say, you know, I think you're going to come in on the next point. For me, it's the Labour Party. What can Labour be doing? Obviously, Keir has
preempted it.
Yes, I'll let you introduce it.
You can ask me the question, I'll try and answer it. No, well, it's exactly that. You know, we've got that election in, you know, at some point next year. Let's say Keir gets into number 10. You know, Lisa Nandy's in Department for Levelling Up. Matt Pennycook's Minister for Housing. What do you want to see a Labour government doing? What needs to change?
So I think, you know, first of all, I'm really grateful that my own Labour MP, Matthew Pennycook, is really on top of articulating what Labour's priorities will be for housing, because I think he really gets it. But more importantly, you know, Keir has set out, and Lisa has also set out the Levelling, the Take Back Control Bill. And I think that's a key opportunity to redefine localism, to really show how we're going to use councils to be able to invest in their areas, how they're going to give over funding to councils to create places. And I think using that bill is a key opportunity to really help shape different areas. And as such, they need to make sure that that Take Back Control Bill really defines the role of local government, because local government understands place, it understands their own areas, it understands their communities. And we're the best people to be able to change our communities hand in hand with our residents. to be able to do that. So if they can define what that bill means, show clear powers that we'll use through that bill in terms of taking back control of our areas, but also ensure that it's adequately resourced and funded to be able to do that, I think you're onto a game winner, and local residents will see that change. Labour needs to make sure that we take that back control of our areas, and that is defined through local government.
I know Lisa and Kira are regular listeners to the podcast as well, so I fully expect this to be featuring heavily in our manifesto next year. Anthony, thank you so much for your time today. It's been fantastic to chat with you.
No, my pleasure. Listen, guys, this is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places. It's been great.
We'll let the listeners decide.
Yeah, I don't think I was a winner of that one. I think I would have not won the interview to do the jingle.
But it was a valiant effort.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
No worries. My pleasure. Take care, everyone.
Well, thanks for listening to another episode of Better Places. We hope not to leave it as long as we have this time, and be back very soon with another guest, another chat, talking about all things planning, property and politics. Speak to you all very soon.
Bye, bye, bye.
Bye, 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 bye.